Mr. Peter Berry, Reel 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Berry?
Yeah, born in London, a place called Branston Court near Paddington, on the 16th of March 1934.
And could you tell us a bit about your family background?
Yes, my father was... he worked for a shirt company, I think, before the First World War. He was born in 1899, so his age is the same as the war, which helps sort of work out where he was and so on and so forth. And he lived in Hampstead, came from a fairly middle-class, well-to-do, upper-middle-class family, I suppose you would call it now. And his father had a shirt business in London. And my mother, I don't know, she never had a job, I don't think. I mean, she was a socialite, if you like, and they got married in 1926, the year of the general strike, and so on and so forth. But I'm going on a little bit now, because beyond the war. Mother was about 4 years younger than him.
And what did you... what was your father's involvement in the First World War?
He joined up, I think, in 1917, and therefore at the age of 17, and did a crash course at Cranwell. Crash is the wrong word, of course, because he learned to be a pilot, and he got his wings, actually, very quickly, I think, because they were obviously desperate for pilots by that stage of 1917, and he joined the RFC. He was posted to France. I'm not quite sure where, but I have some records from Kew of what he did, and he flew a number of types of DHs and things like that. And he was there presumably in 1918, during the last few months of the war. He wasn't a bomber pilot. He wasn't a fighter pilot. I think he did ACAC reconnaissance and that sort of thing, and therefore was fairly near the lines. He spoke inevitably very little about it afterwards. We found out very little about what he did, but he survived the war, obviously, and joined the RNAS before the end of that war, and then was demobbed after the war and went back into the shirt business.
And did his RFC, RAF experiences affect him at all, noticeably, to you as a child?
It didn't affect him in the very slightest, I don't think. I mean, he wasn't a war hero. He didn't get any medals for bravery or anything like that. He didn't talk about it very much. He had a lot of friends in that war and so on, but he was only in it for the war and wanted to get out of it fairly soon afterwards. He was a man who enjoyed life enormously, and he obviously had a bit of money. His father died when he was quite young. I never knew my grandfathers at all, but he was quite comfortably off, and he used to go. He loved the theatre, and he used to go to all the places like the Alhambra, and he joined the Players Theatre Club and all those sort of things, and he had a lot of fun. My mother was, again, a pretty good goer as well. She was a member of Hampstead Ladies Swimming Club and various institutes. They used to go to the Chelsea Arts Ball, and they were in that sort of set in London and enjoyed life enormously.
So tell us a bit about your childhood. Were you living in the Paddington area, or were you in Hampstead at all?
No, I was never lived in Hampstead. I mean, when I was born in 34, we then had a flat over a shop in St. John'swood High Street, within spitting distance of Lord's. That's my earliest days I remember. I had a nanny, and I remember going out in my pram and feeding the ducks in Regent's Park. Those are my earliest memories in the late 30s. I was quite ill. I had my appendix out, I think, in 1938 and had peritonitis at the same time, and still have a scar looking like a bullet wound in the lower part of my abdomen to prove it. So I was quite ill at that time. And then when the war came, Father joined up again immediately in 1939 as a flight lieutenant, and he was stationed in Stanmore. Not at fighter command. He had a balloon. He was in charge of a barrage balloon, and we remember going to see him raising and lowering his barrage balloon. This must have been late 39, early 40, just after the war started. And after that, he was posted. He never left this country. He was posted to various small RAF stations. One was in Cheshire somewhere, Crewkerne, somewhere like that. And then down in Cornwall, he was at a place near Barnstable, can't remember the name of it. And mother then looked after his mother, my grandmother, and all through the war they were together, and I was with them until I was shipped off to various boarding schools. And I was in Bude in Cornwall when father was there.
How did the war affect you? When you weren't evacuated when the war first started then?
I wasn't evacuated at all. I went to boarding school at the tender age of 7 in Bude, and I was at boarding school. That sort of time, yeah, when I was about 7, that's right, yes. And,
do you have any childhood memories of the Blitz then?
Oh, splendid. Lots of childhood memories. In Cornwall, we were right up the sharp end.
No, I mean, in London.
Yes, I was in. We were in London for both the Blitzes. So I was having my tonsils out during the first one. The second one, we had a flat in Dolphin Square. At the point when it was bombed, there was a bomb actually dropped on the other side of it, because Dolphin Square is very near the river and near Fulham, Battersea Power Station, places like that. So we had a lot of bombs raining down, and I remember getting very cross with my mother because I wanted to stand in the window and look at the searchlights and everything going on, and I wasn't allowed to stand in the window. Of course, we never went down below ground into a shelter. We never went down into the tube or anything like that.
Did you have an air raid shelter of your own, or a Morrison
bed? Yeah, at various places where we lived. I mean, we moved 13 times during the war, so I've got some hazy recollections of where we were. But I remember spending a few nights in an Anderson shelter in a bedroom and things like that. We never had an underground air raid shelter wherever I was. And that applied also when I was at various boarding schools.
What about rationing? We'll come to the boarding school separately.
Okay.
But, you know, when you were very young, did rationing affect you at all? I mean, did you notice about sweet rations and things like that?
Yeah, when I got a bit older, I did, yes. My 2 ounces a week or whatever it was, yes. I mean,
not when you were five.
But it never felt a hardship. I mean, you know, we ate whatever we ate, and it was never, I never felt starving in any shape or form like that, no.
Now, so tell me about this boarding school. You went when you were in 1941, when you were 7.
Well, yeah, my first boarding school was in Bude in Cornwall, and I can't remember the name of the school, but it was in a hotel that the school took over called the Penava Hotel in Bude, which is still there to this day. Or there was when we last went to see it, and I was there for, I suppose, until I was 7. 8. I was only there for a couple of years, I think. I then went to a boarding.
Now, what was it like there? Just to give us an idea. Yeah. It seems strange now to send people off to boarding school at 7.
Yeah.
What was it like?
Well, I can't remember very much about it, but I remember that we started. One of the things I remember is being taught Latin at that age, and I was never any good at Latin and failed it in what we then called school certificate all those years later, something like 9 or 10 years later. And it was too soon to learn it, but I was okay at all the other things. I mean, arithmetic and English and so on and so forth, and never had any problems with spelling or writing or anything like that.
Did
so
you miss your parents or get homesick?
Well, I went, no, not really. A few times, one time in particular later on I did, because I had a fairly unhealthy youth. I was ill quite a lot of the time with various things, and I got a bit homesick when I was at my next school, which
so was that?
That was called Burstow Nautical School, and it was in the country outside Hawley in Surrey, and therefore up the sharp end in terms of bombing raids and so on and so forth. And we wore naval uniform, and we had proper collars and dicky bows and hats and things like that. And I was in the school band. I played the cymbals in the school band. And it was run as a sort of semi-naval establishment.
Now,
and
was it formally linked to the Navy or Merchant Navy?
It must have been. We were officially sea cadets, yes. So it must have been linked to the Royal Navy in some shape or form. I mean, for instance, we went about once a month. We went in by the train, in the train down to Shoreham Harbour. And we pulled whalers up and down Shoreham Harbour. I mean, bearing in mind that I was still about 10 or 11 when this was happening, and we were issued with a 17-foot oar, which is what the whaler had, and we pulled these things up and down and then marched all the way back from Hawley Station to the school, which was about 3 miles. So, you know, it was a pretty active life, actually. And we learnt seamanship, and I learnt semaphore, and we had parades and things like that, and a lot of marching about, and so on and so forth. And I remember one specific time, I suppose it must have been late 44, where I was there when the doodlebugs were coming over all the time, and most of them, of course, passed over our heads. We weren't very far from Gatwick Aerodrome. We were about 2 miles away, and there was a squadron or more of American Typhoons there, and so we saw a lot of them, and therefore there was a certain amount of bombing around about because of that. But I remember singing Hearts of Oak on parade on the cricket ground when a doodlebug went over. And we went on singing while the doodlebug went over. Nobody stopped and broke for the cover, but the doodlebug sailed over and went off up towards London. So we've all felt pretty brave after that. But that was quite fun. I quite enjoyed all that. And I was there until I took what we used to call common entrance exam, which was for public school, there at the age of 12 and a half.
That'd be 46.
So I was 46. So it was after the war, that's right. And
so you
I,
were there about 42, 46?
Yes, it's about 4 or 5 years, something like that. And there were boys there up to the age of 17 or 18. It wasn't a normal prep school in that sense. So they were there from right up to about 18, some of them, you know. And it was a good place.
What was the standard of teaching like there? I mean, you know, they've got all this naval training, seamanship, and
I think it was fairly good. I can remember one or two of the masters quite well, but you can't remember them all, obviously, you know. I think it was fairly good because although I took common entrance to get into Marlborough, and I failed it, in fact. I failed, but partly because I failed the Latin, which was an essential thing in those days to get in, not just to university, but into a public school. And I failed it. Not very badly, but father did a bit of asking about and knew one or two influential people. And although I failed for Marlborough, I got into another school called Malvern, which is, of course, a successful and big public school to this day. And Malvern had a wonderful war. They had what they called two exiles. They were chucked out of Malvern, I won't go into this in great detail, in about 1940, and it was taken over by the TRE organization, Telecommunications Research Establishment, and so they were thrown out, and then they went to Blenheim Palace for a year, and they then joined with Harrow, and on a much reduced basis. And when they went back to Malvern in 46, they were building up from about 100 boys, trying to build up back to up to about 500 or 600, something like that. And so they were taking people, failed common entrance people like me. So I went to Malvern in 47, September 47, and I was in the lowest form, the fourth form, of which I came top the first term. So I wasn't a complete dunce, which reflects back on your question about the education at my previous school, which obviously wasn't too bad, you know.
Now, what was Malvern like? What do you recall?
Wonderful. I loved every minute of it, and used to, in the school holidays, look forward to going back at the beginning of the next term.
What was so good about it?
The people. The masters, who were human beings and friends, I had made a lot of friends there. I was lucky in the sense that I was the sporting. I was never very good at sport, but I loved it. I was passionate about cricket. I wasn't passionate about football. They played soccer at Malvern, which I didn't like very much. We played rugger in the spring term, which I did like very much. I was reasonable at athletics, quite a fast runner and so on. But if you liked sport, then you made friends and you were, I suppose, more popular and so on and so forth. I went up the school rungs of the ladder on the education side in the normal way, nothing spectacular. Took school certificate, passed it, eventually got a thing which they called matriculation, which meant 5 credits. You've probably heard about all these things from other people. And I could then, and after 4 years, I had to leave. Father, the money ran out, and Granny wouldn't. Granny had paid for my sister. I haven't mentioned my sister at all. So my sister had a good education at a place called Benenden, and a good prep school before that. And Granny paid for her education, but she didn't pay for mine. So the money ran out after 4 years, so I couldn't go to university or anything like that.
You were there till what, 51?
I was there till 51, correct. Yeah, I left at the end of the summer 51.
Did you do OTC training?
Yes, we had we called it the CCF then, Combined Cadet Force. And I was in that, and I enjoyed that, and we had proper battle dress and so on, and we took the examination called Certificate A, Cert A, which I'm sure you've heard of.
Tell me about the training with the CCF. What exactly training did you do? How often and what level of
training? Well, we did a lot of drill. We did arms drill. We had rifles, and we did arms drill. We did field days, and we had afternoons when we did section attacks, platoon attacks, company attacks. It was all infantry-based rather than anything else, for fairly obvious economic reasons, I suppose, and it's a good basis. And I enjoyed all that too. We had very good field days, which were done in
the typical field day line.
Typical field day, up at the normal sort of time, breakfast, 3-ton lorry out to British camp. And the Malvern Hills, of course, you will realize, are a splendid training ground for things like that. And a 3-ton lorry out to somewhere like British camp, which is at the far end of the Malvern Hills, and then doing probably company attacks against other companies and so on and so forth, issued with blank ammunition, and sort of number one section behind the hedge over there, two and three over here, and all this sort of stuff, you know. And we took all the proper exams, and I passed Cert A, which was a little red badge you put on your shoulder here. We won my house. We had 10 houses at Malvern. My house won the, we had quite a formal and serious drill competition, between inter-house drill competition, which my house won in my last year there. We were very good. We drilled extremely well, and there was a, you know, it was hard, quite hard work. I didn't, I don't think I got farther. I think I got a stripe. I got Lance Corporal, I think, but I didn't get any further up the hierarchy than that. But I was average, you know, all the way through. I didn't get into any of the first 11s thing. I played cricket for my house, and I shot a bit. I shot 303 a bit, but not. I could have probably been a better shot, as you will hear in due course. I did quite a lot of shooting in the army quite well. It was probably my best sport, but I didn't do much of it at school because it stopped me playing cricket, and I wanted to play cricket.
So what were you going to do when the money ran out and you had to leave?
Money came out. I was 17 and a bit, and I had 6 months to mark time before knowing that I was going to be called up for national service. So Father knew. We had some very great friends. The father of the family of whom was owned an advertising agency in London, and in those days, one did what one's father told you to do. And my father said, "There's a desk for you in that advertising agency. Go and do some work for 6 months in London and learn a bit about advertising, and before you do your national service." So I said, "Yes, Father, of course I will." And off I went to a firm called Willings Press Service at the top of Gray's Inn Road near King's Cross, and started being a trainee advertising man in this very comfortable, small, nice firm. And my best friend worked there as well, who was the son of the chairman. And he became our best man at our wedding later on. He was a good bloke. And so I worked there for 6 months, and not terribly hard, but because I didn't believe in hard work and so on and so forth. And I was paid, I think, something like £4 a week, which more than covered my fares from Stanmore to King's Cross and back, and gave me a bit of money over for beer and so on and so forth. I played rugger at home for Harrow Rugby Club, which was nothing to do with the school, the town, which was in Stanmore. And I played cricket for Stanmore Cricket Club as well in the summer. And I had a lot of girlfriends long before I met this dear lady. And And we had a lot of fun, and it was tremendous. And the winter passed very easily.
What exactly was your work? I mean, were you just office duties,
I went into what they call the production department, which is the department that organises the making of blocks, as they then were, for advertisements. And I used to have to deliver blocks to offices in Fleet Street and the magazines roundabout, and I used to have to deliver artwork to various places. And I got involved in the production process of producing advertisements from the artwork through to block making or whatever was needed for litho, gravure, mainly letterpress work in those days, and so on and so forth. and I did a short spell in the media department, which is planning campaigns in press, and there was no television in those days, press and magazines and posters, advertising and things like that. And I think that was about all. And I probably was just about starting to be an assistant trainee account executive and met a few clients and went round with other people meeting clients and finding out how that thing worked. So I made quite a lot of progress, really, in 6 months, and I was well looked after.
So you were there, what, 51 into 52?
Yes, I went there in, I suppose, September 51, and I left just before I joined the army, which was in May 52.
Now, tell me about the whole call-up process. You know, I mean, you've no question of deferment.
No. I wanted to do it and get through it quickly. And I wanted to join the army because I wanted to get a commission. That was my objective. And you could do 2 years in the army and get a commission. You may have thought, as I did, I'd like to have gone into the Navy. But to get a commission in the Navy, you had to do 3 years. And I didn't want to be in for 3 years. So I forsook the Navy.
What was the whole call-up procedure? How did it start? What was the first intimation you had?
Very quickly. Well, one knew it was happening. One knew exactly when one was going to be called up, so it didn't come as a great surprise. I mean, at the age of 18 years and 3 months, you got called up. The actual call-up notification didn't arrive until the 26th of April, which was, 3 weeks before I actually got called up. 26th of April it arrived, and not with no surprise at all, and I suppose I was sent a travel warrant, and I was told to report to a training regiment in Catterick on the 15th of May. So I got in a train at King's Cross that morning and met one or two other blokes who were obviously going to the same place as I, one or two of whom I knew, and up we went to Catterick camp.
Now, who were you joining at Catterick?
The 68th Training Regiment RAC.
Now, why the RAC, Royal Army Corps?
Royal Army Corps, that's right.
Did you pick them, or...?
Yes, I think... I'm vague about that, but I think... I don't know. It may have been luck, I don't know. I can't remember, actually, whether one had the choice of where one went initially, but... there I went anyway, and it was what I wanted to do. I mean, I hadn't really any particular thoughts about tanks or anything at that stage. My only objectives at that stage were to get a commission so that I could live more comfortably and to go as far away from home as I possibly could at the Queen's expense or the King's expense. No, it was the Queen's expense by that time. She had acceded the throne in February. And that's what I wanted to do.
Now, when you go to something like this, obviously although you've been in the CCF, you're still a newcomer. What was your reception like when you arrived at Catterick camp?
It was okay. I mean, there was, and this applies right through my 4 months at Catterick. The sergeants and the corporals who were in charge of us, basically, were basically nice guys. There was none of the sort of bullying and harrying about that you see on these dreadful television programs we've had on army recruiting today. You know, there was no bullying. I mean, yeah, kit got thrown out of the window if it was dirty. Extra parades were called and all that. We're going too far ahead. Okay, yeah. Fine. Okay.
Reception. What happened when you first arrived? When you went through the gates, how did they sort of take you in? Because you arrive as a civilian and sort of a short period later you're not.
Yes.
And it's
that's
the
right.
Process of receiving you, kitting you out, the rest of it.
Well, one was sent to a place where you had a bed and you put your own stuff, you had a locker and so on, and you found out where to go and have tea that afternoon and so on, and nothing else happened. The next day we started getting kit and queuing for this, that and the other. It didn't all happen on the first day. Most of our kit took about 3 days to actually arrive, but we had enough to stand. We only had denims, I think. We didn't have battle dress or anything like that to start with, nothing like that. And I can't even remember having a hat. Certainly no weapon, nothing like that, obviously. But
you get the boots and
yeah, I think gradually it all happened over the first 2 or 3 days. I think it was a Thursday we went up there. So the army, as you know, shuts down on Saturday lunchtime anyway, so I don't think anything very much happened until the following Monday in that case. But we had a platoon sergeant by that time, and I met all the other blokes. We were in an intake. I think it was 5209 was our intake, I think, and we were given a regimental. One got one's number fairly quickly, and you met the other blokes, and we were in a spider in a dormitory with about 24 other people.
Do you remember your number? I believe you do remember.
Yeah, 22671052. Trooper Barry P, I was. That's right. That's who I was.
What was the accommodation like? It's a hut, a spider hut. Can you explain? Because people don't know what a spider hut is now.
Yeah, I mean, it's a wooden hut, I suppose 30, 40 yards long, and it had two, about, there were about, it was rather like an H block, I think, and people do know what an H block is, like the Belfast prison and so on and so forth. And it had a sort of communications part in the middle of it, I think, and there were about four wings, and they were called spiders. I suppose they had eight legs, I don't know, but I don't think ours had eight legs and so on, but they were called spiders.
What was the actual room, though?
And it was quite roomy. There was the beds were sprung, they were okay, we had a locker by the side of it, bit like a very crude hospital ward was in those days, if you like. And I think there was probably 2 metres between the beds, something like that. It was fairly light and airy. There were a lot of windows. The ablutions weren't indoors. The ablutions were in a separate block and pretty crude. The loos, I think, had doors. The sit-down loos had doors. There was therefore privacy. Obviously, there was a stand-up urinals as well. The basins were sort of all very close together. Whether there were mirrors for shaving in, I can't remember. They were pretty crude, and the water was more or less cold, and so on and so forth. That wasn't very good, you know.
So now, what we look at is we look at a typical day's training, ignoring the fact there's no such thing as a typical day, really. But I mean,
right.
And we sort of that way pick up all what life was like, conditions of service during this 3 months, I think you said, or 4 months of training. So how would your day, once you got settled in and you're in your squad and you're ready, how would your day start as a young trainee trooper?
Parade with the sergeant. Lots and lots of drill, of course. Within 3 days of training started, I was interviewed by a major and virtually put down as being a potential officer, I suppose, within about 3 days of getting there.
Let's divert onto that. So what was that process? So what was the interview like?
Friendly, informal, rather along the lines of, as we've been doing today, finding out about my background, what I did, where I went to school, what my parents were like, and so on. So very much, very similar to the sort of things we've been talking about this morning. One was still in the squad. I mean, there was 5 weeks basic training. That was the point, which was drill, PT, getting people fit, and so on. I'd like, may I just go back a little bit?